I'm sure you're all getting a little bit sick of me. I've been on stage quite a bit this morning, but please be patient. I am very excited to have an extraordinary guest, Secretary Ernie Moniz, for a fireside. We don't have any crackles here. We're going to imagine them. But Secretary, thank you for being here.
A fireplace would be a bit out of place here, I think, with the weather. Anyway, pleasure, Chris.
Wonderful. So we're obviously here at a historic COP characterized by a truly historic announcement, that of the aspiration and the pledge to triple nuclear energy around the world. I said yesterday that I don't want to use the F word in polite company. In this case, that F word is failure. And given the challenges that we face with climate change, failure is truly not an option at the present moment. We are setting for ourselves an extraordinarily ambitious goal with this tripling of nuclear energy. And there have been brief moments in the history of nuclear power where we have deployed at scale. And some of those are historic examples. We can think of the Mesmer plan in France, the Swedish deployment. But we also have contemporary examples of our hosts here at the UAE who have deployed nuclear at an extraordinary speed. Secretary, you have been very involved, I understand, with the playbook. This is a really exciting initiative aimed at embarking nations, sharing some of the best practices. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and the study that you did in order to develop some of those key points?
Sure. In fact, the playbook was a collaboration, I should say, first between the Energy Futures Initiative, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, and the Clean Air Task Force. We came together and released that report here at COP28. Let me just say as background, you mentioned the tripling event of last Saturday, which was indeed very, very welcome, with more than 20 countries engaged. But if we're going to meet the tripling by mid-century, including, you know, some plants retiring, et cetera, in round terms, we're talking terawatt kind of build over this next quarter century. In our view, to achieve that, to achieve, you know, an average of 45 gigawatts a year, roughly speaking, 50% higher than the peak experience back in the 80s, we're going to need contributions across the board. Countries that already have significant nuclear programs, down to embarking countries that have no program but are very interested. And we've seen here at COP28, I should say, not just the tripling announcement, but extraordinary interest from embarking countries on multiple continents wanting to move forward. So what we did was, recognizing that embarking countries, we think, will have a significant role in a success strategy to triple nuclear power, we did this playbook. The playbook, and I urge you all to go to the website of any of the three organizations to see it posted. The idea is, we said, okay, look, here are six areas that must be addressed successfully. Not some of them, all of them. Project execution, regulatory structures, financeability, non-proliferation and security, a vision of where you're going on spent fuel management, and very importantly, workforce building, which is critical for the embarking countries. But I want to emphasize, a lot of this applies more generally. For example, on the workforce side, I would posit that I just don't see the workforce in the nuclear domain globally that is fit for purpose to building 45, 50 gigawatts in a year. So we've all got a job to do in terms of building that workforce. The Emirates, as you already mentioned, are a fantastic example of a country that embarked less than two decades ago and was extraordinarily successful, including on the workforce development and, of course, the regulatory development and across the board. Now we have to move that forward, and we think that We have examples, of course, for each of these six areas. In fact, I should say also, very importantly, our approach here was to be non-prescriptive. It's not up to us to tell country X how to move forward. Our point is there's multiple ways of meeting every one of the six objectives. And what we try to do is emphasize the options that an embarking country in particular, maybe some countries that have been, are about to re-embark. The United States, I would argue, has just re-embarked with one reactor now built from scratch. So individual countries must choose their own set of options across the spectrum to be successful. As I mentioned, for the workforce, it's true in all the areas. We all need to work together on this, because success in this will require all of us on deck and all of us, to mix metaphors, in the shell, rowing at the same time. There's always a joke about, I won't go into it in detail, but when a particular school wanted to start a new program of rowing, and they found that they were having terrible success versus the times that, you know, Harvard would have, you know, et cetera. And they sent a spy to look at the practice sessions. He found the answer. He said, only one guy is yelling and eight guys are rowing. And I think that's exactly the kind of attitude we need to build this global nuclear establishment.
You know, I was chuckling as you were speaking because you absolutely stole my thunder with this word re-embarking nations. It's very interesting looking at the signatories of the pledge and also looking at the 60 nuclear reactors currently under construction around the world. BRICS is coming back into the parlance, certainly in the media.
BRICS Plus.
Yeah, so Brazil, Russia, India, China. Of the 60 reactors currently under construction, 46 of those are being built by Russia, India, and China. Unfortunately, only one in the U.S., four in Europe. This is a time of real challenge in the West. And so the lessons that I've seen in the nuclear playbook, they're directed, I believe, at embarking nations. But I'm wondering if the program that's being prescribed could be equally followed by re-embarking nations. And it was very interesting to see that the suggestions were actually quite technologically conservative. The importance of picking a standardized design, serial building of that design, you know, narrowing down the field, low-enriched fueled PWRs once through fuel cycles. Is this the path that re-embarking nations should be taking alongside the embarking nations? Or in other words, should we be following our own advice in the West?
Absolutely. So certainly for embarking nations, we think that many of those factors are elevated, but they are not unique to the embarking countries. Let me take the United States, and I'll talk about a concern and a feature in the playbook that definitely would carry over. The concern is that for truth in advertising, let me just say, I am on the board of the Southern Company, whose subsidiary is building those two reactors in the state of Georgia, not the country of Georgia. The first plant, with all of its trials and tribulations, has been operating now for months and operating incredibly well. And I think that's exactly what I think many of us have come to see in nuclear power, that we got to execute the project, and when we do, it is just an enormous contribution to supply, to reliability, to resilience, et cetera. However, I'll be straightforward. We will complete, we believe, the second plant in the first quarter of the coming year, so just in a few months. We expect it will operate like the third plant at that site very, very well. But there's nothing else on the books. So we heard earlier this week from Mohammed Al-Hamadi, the CEO of ENEC, what incredible learning there was here in the Emirates in terms of building the second and the third and now the fourth reactor. I'll say here, the same is true in Georgia with two reactors. For example, those deep into the engineering and commissioning of nuclear plants will know that something like hot functional testing is one of the critical phases in bringing a plant online. I can say publicly, that the time to do that for the fourth unit or the second new unit was 40% of the time of the first unit. And so collectively, we have a huge interest in sharing experience, information, learning. Well, in the United States, we've just built two of these reactors or are about to have built two. I don't know what's going to happen to all that experience and knowledge because we don't have an order book where we see more being built. So as we go forward, whether it's with gigawatt scale reactors or small modular reactors, we need to have, yes, a down selection. I don't mean to one, but we certainly are not going to support 70 different designs. We need to focus where a set of customers, and this is the relevant part from the playbook, aggregation is critical, aggregation of demand around specific designs so that one can emphasize all that learning experience and drive the cost down, drive the schedule down, and make this truly a highly, highly competitive and essential part of a clean electricity future.
I want to talk a little bit about...
By the way, I said electricity. I can add heat as
and
well.
Heat,
but, you know,
and heat,
but
a anyway. Very important application for decarbonization of difficult-to-abate sectors, absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about the challenges of nuclear finance and the International Bank for Nuclear Infrastructure. Why don't we've been focusing a little bit on the U.S. itself. Let's broaden this more internationally. Tell us about the vision there and any developments that are occurring.
So what Chris is referring to here, just to be a little bit more clear, is that in the playbook, many of the options are relevant, let's say, to the near term, because we can't wait, as has been a pretty regular theme. But we also, in the playbook, propose, and the Clean Air Task Force is particularly an advocate here. We all are, but they really were the lead on proposing a set of new international institutions in, for example, in regulation, but also potentially in finance with a multilateral bank that is really focused on nuclear. At least I'll speak for myself that a prime motivation for that, and it doesn't mean we have to do that. Institution building takes time. That's not a near-term thing. And if it happens, it may be especially important for embarking countries, but very important for other countries as well. Frankly, I have to say that in my view, if you look at the World Bank, if you look at some of the other multilateral development banks, let me say the World Bank, I don't believe that there is a reluctance at this stage to help in the international finance of new nuclear, seeing all of the benefits and all of the momentum that's built up, including here at COP28. However, the reality is when you don't do something for a long time, you lose the memory of how to do it. And that includes, I would posit, the finance of very large nuclear projects. So we have a workforce issue, not only in terms of building a nuclear reactor, but in financing it and et cetera. And a new institution dedicated to nuclear could be the answer, or it could be building up the capacity in one or more of the existing institutions. But you don't just finance these things, especially at billions of dollars, without having the appropriate skill sets to do so.
I want to return again to, I guess, some of the anxieties I'm feeling. I'm feeling mixed emotions here at COP. Obviously, a tremendous amount of hope and excitement, but frankly, some anxiety because nuclear is difficult. I feel like there's a real need to study both the successes and the failures and to learn some of those lessons to make sure we're carrying best practices forward. I am an emergency physician. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I have heard the diagnosis of industrial ADHD applied to the nuclear sector. We obviously learned very painful lessons at Vogtle, but I think there's been a tendency to maybe try and sweep those under the rug and focus on the next shiny thing, whether that's a new reactor design or another product. Do you feel like we have learned the lessons of Vogtle? Are we being transparent enough? Are we talking about it enough as an industry, as a community? Should we even be talking about that with the public in terms of gaining confidence back that we can do nuclear well?
I certainly feel that there is a lot of room for much, much better exchange of data and experience. It's especially useful when one is talking within a similar or identical, ideally identical, nuclear design, but even when one is not, there are many lessons that can be shared. For example, here, you know, in the Emirates, with the Korean design, in the United States, and in China with AP1000s, et cetera. Well, these are similar scale Europe, similar scale pressurized water reactors, and there are certainly some lessons that are going to apply across the board. Some lessons will be very specific to the design, and that's where we think that, again, customers should define which technology, which specific technology they want in building up an order book. But the reality is, we all understand that there are competitive pressures as well, and that leads to less data sharing than could be desired. I will again go back to the United States and say, and this is not just, this is not nuclear per se, but more broadly, at the Energy Futures Initiative, we published a report. It weighs about 1.2 kilograms or so on improving the innovation approaches used by the government, in this case, especially the Department of Energy, as the Congress directed and the administration and DOE move towards much more activity in large-scale demonstration and deployment of clean energy technologies. Our problem is the public money is going into these projects, you know, in some matching fashion. And I don't believe, and we wrote this and made some recommendations, public money is going in. I think one of the biggest rewards to the taxpayer should be data sharing, because we put in public money and then the companies maintain, keep all of the information basically as proprietary. Now, there are going to be some know-how issues that probably still will be in that ballpark, but there's no reason why we could not require, as part of the deal, that there will be much more data sharing so that all companies can benefit from the experience, positive and negative, going forward.
Secretary, there's so much more I would have loved to have asked you, but we are down on the clock to the final 50 seconds. So I'm going to end with maybe one of those cheesy questions. But in your time here in the Emirates and everything that you've seen, what gives you the most hope moving forward on, again, meeting this challenge of tripling nuclear energy?
Well, I think the on nuclear energy specifically, I think that number one, I just want to go back to the original thing. We cannot underestimate the importance of the kind of discussion, level of discussion and momentum built up in nuclear. And it's no accident, in my view, that it occurred at COP28 in the Emirates, because the Emirates have stature for this discussion of building nuclear programs successfully. And that's very important. People who walk the talk tend to get more attention than those who don't. But at the next stage, and not necessarily on the main stages like this one, I think there's so much discussion going on about the nuts and bolts of doing things like new financeability options, building the workforce. I think it's gotten a lot of attention in the discussions that I've seen. So I think it's both the high level interest and momentum and a lot of the conversations going on to really implement. But if I may, in the remaining 49 seconds, say that more broadly than nuclear. Oh, by the way, sorry, on nuclear, I have to say that another first, in my view, the tripling of nuclear energy by mid-century, we should now begin to think of in terms of an additional terawatt of both fission and fusion. There was one event, but that's the message. It wasn't zero events. There was one event on fusion, which I think must have been the first time the word fusion was ever pronounced in a COP event in its history. And that really goes to the point I was going to make, which is that I found the discussions at this COP, certainly up to now, through the first week and plus, to be much more pragmatic. We're not just wallowing in wind, solar, and batteries, as important as they are. I mean, and they are very, very important. But nuclear fission, nuclear fusion, CCS, all of these on the agenda and being discussed in a spirit that I think is really taking hold. Namely, when it comes to climate, there are other motivations, but when it comes to climate, let's stop the discussion about which technology is preferred, which is not. We need all of these technologies. We need them at scale. We need them at pace. We don't have time to waste our time on some of these other discussions. And I've been very encouraged, and I'll end by speaking from the United States perspective. Secretary Kerry, I've been with him in multiple events here. He and I have a history, shall we say, I won't go into. But every event he has done, whether it's fission or fusion or CCS, he has mentioned all three. And that is a significant evolution, I think, in the position that we have to be pragmatic, as I said, and advance across the board.
Secretary, we've warped the space-time continuum. That 49 seconds was incredible. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Secretary Moniz.
Thank you.